Wait. Before we start, just want to make sure we're clear here. While this podcast talks about sobriety, mental health, and addiction, it is not meant to replace professional medical advice. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety.
I'm Kathleen.
And I'm Sonia.
And we're ex-sisters-in-law, brought together in marriage and bonded through our sobriety journey.
Join us as we talk sobriety, addiction, and everything in between. You're in for quite a ride. And our Substack is buzzing with amazing content, from creative mocktail recipes to insightful courses and reflective exercises. There is something for everyone. Don't miss out. It's a great way to add some extra joy and depth to your journey. Check it out. Welcome back to Sisters in Sobriety. Today, we are honored to have Hadley Sorensen join us. She is a writer, a speaker, a sobriety advocate who is helping women redefine their relationship with alcohol in an empowering and stigma-free way.
Hadley's journey to sobriety wasn't about hitting rock bottom. It was about recognizing that alcohol was no longer serving her, even when everything on the outside looked perfect. She challenges the outdated belief that you have to label yourself as an alcoholic to quit drinking, offering a fresh perspective for women who want to reclaim their clarity, confidence, and joy without waiting for things to fall apart.
She is the author of The Dirty Truth on Social Drinking, where she takes a critical look at social drinking culture, particularly mommy wine culture, which normalizes alcohol as a coping mechanism for women. And she speaks candidly about the hidden ways alcohol can undermine our well-being, even when it's socially accepted. Welcome, Hadley.
Thank you so much for having me. Thanks for that introduction. That was great. I was like, oh, I should take notes.
We love a good introduction. Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit about your personal turning point in deciding to stop drinking?
Yeah, absolutely. I was someone who always drank socially, right? What we think of as social drinking. And we put that label on it and we think, well, I'm a social drinker, so I can't possibly have a problem. Started back like so many of us did in high school, drinking sort of to fit in. I went to a big college with a really intense binge drinking culture. And that was how I learned to drink overboard, to excess, you know, not every day, but when you did, it was sort of extreme and that was celebrated. And so then I went right from college, pretty quickly transitioned into the mommy wine culture, where again, we thought what we were doing was fine because now we were wearing nice clothes and we were sipping fancy wine and we were, you know, now we were sitting around the cul-de-sac with our neighbors while we had the baby monitor so we could listen for the kids. And from the outside, like you said, I looked like I had my act together. I was successful. I was driven. But I always felt like something about my relationship with alcohol was really off. It felt really toxic. It didn't feel good. But because, you know, we think that there's only these two categories of people, right? Either you're a raging alcoholic or you're a normal drinker. And because I didn't fall into one bucket, I felt like I had to be in the other. So I just had to keep going. I had to figure it out. And I just never felt good about it. I had so much shame tied to my drinking, so much regret, so much angst. It was really taking a toll on my mental health. And this went on for decades. And finally, it was in 2021 when it started to build and some little events had sort of been accumulating that were kind of nudging me closer to kind of my end point. And I woke up one morning in the summer of 2021 with a hangover, and I decided it needed to be my last hangover. I was really sick and tired of feeling sick and tired and acting like I was somehow powerless, like it was inevitable, like I couldn't do anything about it. And I decided I was going to do something about it. And so that was indeed my last hangover 3.5 years ago. And I have not looked back. It wasn't always easy, but I stood very firm in my conviction that that was it for me. Something felt different. Something fundamental sort of shifted in me. And I knew that that was the end. And, you know, I had taken lots of other breaks over the years, lots of other, you know, a month here, a few weeks there, but they were always driven by those moments where you wake up and you think, oh, I'm never drinking again, right? Because it was that horrible hangover. But those breaks were always breaks. I knew that my goal was to go back to drinking. I was just trying to reset myself so that I could be like a normal, moderate drinker.
Yeah.
And that clearly never worked. So this time in 2021, it just felt, everything about it felt different. I knew that this was it for me. So that's what, you know, ultimately led me here to this point. And I, you know, if you had told 4 years ago Hadley that she'd be speaking about sobriety on podcasts and written a book, I mean, she would never have believed you.
Oh, I hear that. So this is something I wish I knew like 10 years ago, which is what are those little red flags that made you think, probably over the year or two before you quit drinking, like something is off? What were those red flags?
Yeah, wow. Well, let's just say that I was a master at ignoring red flags. I mean, I started paying attention to them probably in the 2 years leading up to when I quit, but they had been there. Let's be clear. They had been flying in the wind for decades. The first was that I was a blackout drinker. Nothing about that is normal. Nothing about it is normal. That in and of itself should be a huge red flag. But I ignored it for so long. Another red flag was that I constantly felt ashamed. I had so much shame that I stuffed really deep down inside, you know, where shame loves to live, about my drinking. Another red flag was the fact that I was always trying to make a change and I couldn't. I was always making these promises to myself, like, you know, oh, Monday is a fresh start. I'm going to drink less, or I'm not going to black out anymore. The fact that I was always grappling with the idea of moderation, but could never get there. I could never make a shift. I mean, all of these things are red flags. You know, some of them for gray area drinking, some of them for, you know, beyond. I just was an expert at burying my head in the sand and ignoring it. The fact that my mental health was suffering, that was one of the things in the 2 years leading up to when I quit. That was the red flag that I really started to pay attention to that I'd been ignoring for so long. Hey, these depressive episodes that happen after a hangover, they're very directly tied to your drinking. So that was one of the big things that I started noticing, paying more attention to and acknowledging instead of hiding from it. Those are just a few.
I relate to some of those for sure. I really do. Those small red flags. What does rock bottom really mean? And why do you think it's a myth that you have to hit it to quit?
Well, I think the myth is that it is really tied to what we think of as like that stereotypical rock bottom, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's like someone stumbling around with a brown paper bag on a park bench, or you're like, you know, drinking in the morning and you're getting DUIs and your kids are getting taken away, like all of these dramatic external consequences that we sort of associate with problematic drinking. I think the myth is, you know, you don't need to wait for it to get that bad. Mm-hmm. Maybe we all have a rock bottom and it's just wherever we decide that we're done. You know, my rock bottom didn't look anything like the stereotype. I didn't even drink every day. I certainly didn't drink in the morning. I still had these rules that I wasn't like hiding alcohol around the house. No judgment if that's your story. I'm just saying we don't have to wait until we get to that point. Your rock bottom can just be, you know what, I'm tired of having hangovers. So this is where I get off the hamster wheel. I think it's just wherever we decide to stop and we've had enough.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree.
Yeah, I totally agree too. I think I come across a lot of people in my therapy practice that they have that perception. Well, my drinking isn't problematic because I haven't hit rock bottom. And it's interesting that term rock bottom, right? Like what does it mean? So I relate right. to what you say, mm-hmm. both personally and then professionally, I relate to it.
I was just going to say there's like different versions of this metaphor, but mm-hmm. but it's like if you were cooking and your pan caught on fire, you would put the lid over the pan or you would put it in the sink and you would put that fire out. You wouldn't throw up your hands and say, oh my gosh, well, the house is on fire now, and just wait for it to spread to the right. curtains and take the whole that house down. You don't, if something feels problematic, address it. Don't wait for the whole house to burn down.
Yeah, I think that's a really good metaphor. Like you wouldn't have that fire in the pan and be like, well, I can't do anything about it until the right. whole house burns down, right?
I
think what's interesting is I've been writing a little bit, and I was writing about one of my worst drinking events. I call it drunk porn, kind of like the really bad stuff. Mm-hmm. And so it happened like a year before I quit, right? The day I quit, yeah, I had a bad hangover, but you know, I think the shame over those bigger events, I remember drinking the next night after, like, it wasn't that dramatic. I mean, I just woke up on the bathroom floor and, you know, had vomited and wasn't sure if it was like blood or red wine, but I drank that next night, right? And so it shocks me still that, yeah, I think I was so ashamed that it took another year of hangovers to mm-hmm. quit. And so was that the rock bottom? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I had sort of a similar experience. It was a surprise party I threw for my husband in 2019. So, you know, 2 years before I quit, that was kind of the first wake up call that nudged me closer. And that was an extreme one. It was really bad. And then the hangover that prompted me to call it quits was nothing to write home about. It yeah. was just a little, you know, a little day drinking that left me with yep. a sour stomach and the chills, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hadley, how do you think we untangle drinking from our identity when it's so embedded in our social lives?
That is such a good question. And that's one that was tough for me because I had really made my love of wine like a pillar of my identity. Yeah. And I was on social media as a health and fitness coach, spreading all of the tacky, icky wine culture stuff. Yeah. Like my whole shtick was I was this wine loving mom of boys. Like you could have balance, you could be fit and healthy and still love your wine, and here's how I balance it all. And so when I quit, it was like, who am I if I take out that wine stuff? And honestly, I have to say I realized really quickly that it had all been BS, that wasn't really who mm-hmm. I was. But it was a combination of things. One, it was doing a lot of self-care and really aggressively mm-hmm. taking care of myself during those like first 6 months as I figured all of this out. It was kind of, and I know, you know, people don't like to hear this, but I was yeah. trying to figure out what I wanted my social life to look like. And all of my friends still drank. They were very supportive, but they all still drank. So I pulled away a little bit. I know people yeah. feel like it's going to be the end of their social life. And it absolutely wasn't, but I like turned down invites to a few things. I stayed in a lot. I was just kind of like focused on myself, and that was what I needed at the time. Even though like it's scary to say no and to stop going out and to do things because we think, oh, this is it. This is the end. I'm going to be a hermit. I'm going to lose all my friends. Mm-hmm. That's not the case. So it was self-care. It was kind of redefining what I wanted my social life to look like. It was then I was kind of aggressive about planning things with my friends that didn't revolve around alcohol. Uh-huh. So we could do things that, and they were so open to it. So, you know, I don't go out at night much anymore, but I meet friends for coffee every week. We go for walks. Mm-hmm. I have tons of friends that I meet and we go for walks, or we play pickleball, or we, you know, we go to coffee, we go to lunch. And our relationships feel like deeper and more fulfilling. And if everybody's going out for wine on Saturday night and I choose not to go, I don't really feel like I'm missing anything. Right. So it was a process of that, of the self-care, of really kind of looking inward. And for me, it was learning to appreciate myself as the introvert that I am, instead of continuing to use alcohol to force myself to be an extrovert and do things I don't really enjoy doing. Mm-hmm. But I slowly started to, you know, untangle that thread of like my wine loving persona and realize that I hadn't needed that all along. Mm-hmm. But it takes time. It takes work. It's not an overnight kind of thing. But really, I can tell anyone that for sure your drinking is like the least interesting thing mm-hmm. about you. So even when we think that that's an important part of who we are, I promise it's not.
And so, Abby, I think some of us go from identifying as like fun, like wine girl, to then really getting deep into sobriety and really taking on this, I identify as an alcoholic, but you don't necessarily go for that label. Can you tell me just a little bit about how you navigate that?
Yeah. I mean, nothing about that label resonated with me or worked for me. And I think for people that it does, and that is an important part of their journey, identifying as an alcoholic and all of the things that go along with that, I think that's awesome. My only point is there are no rules to this. Mm-hmm. We get to do this in whatever way feels right to me. I don't mm-hmm. have to call myself an alcoholic for my journey to be valid. I don't, just nothing about that label feels right for me. So I don't use it. And I don't think that I have to. I do think being sober can be a big part of our identity, and that's fine. But again, you get to make the own rules. I would say for me, I think people think that I like live and breathe sobriety and it's this huge part of my life. Well, it just happens to be the part that I talk about publicly on Instagram and my book day to day. It's not something that I really even think about anymore. And again, I qualify this. I was very much a gray area drinker, right? There are people who need to work a program every day and really be, you know, again, alcohol use disorder is a spectrum. And depending on where you fell on that spectrum, the journey is going to look different for you. But we don't have to label ourselves or put ourselves into any certain category in order to be successful. I see, you know, people, trolls on Instagram all the time will tell me that this is never gonna stick because I don't go to AA or because I don't call myself an alcoholic or whatever. I have no problem with any of those labels, programs. Yeah. It's whatever works for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't want to speak for you, Sonia, but I think we would share the same sentiment. Like we have nothing against 12-step programs at all, at all. However, neither of us, that's not how we got sober. So,
but I agree though with Hadley that when you are not in 12-step and you are talking about sobriety publicly, there is definitely
the
potential for backlash from people that think that that's the only way to get sober. And for some people, it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think for so long, it was the only path to sobriety that anyone knew or had ever heard of, right? And, you know, and that being said, AA, 12-step programs, all of that, they get plenty of publicity, right? Publicity is probably not the right word. But I think it's important that more of us are talking about the other paths, so more people know that that exists, because I think that whole idea turns a lot of people off or keeps them stuck. It did for me for a long time, because I thought, well, you only quit drinking if you hit that stereotypical rock bottom. Mm-hmm. And the only way to do it is to call yourself an alcoholic and go to AA. And that didn't feel right to me at all. I was like, I might only drink once a week. Like, this doesn't make sense. I'm not an alcoholic. So that, you know, held me off for a long time from making a change, because that was all I knew. That was all I'd heard of.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And what do you think, Hadley, was the biggest unexpected benefit of going alcohol free?
It's hard to pick. I would say it would be sort of the peace that comes along with it. It's just the sense of, I don't know how to describe it. If you were someone who drank like, you know, we did, there's this all constant sense of chaos and upheaval and unpredictability. Every night I would go out, you never knew which version of Hadley was going to end the night. And then how was I going to feel for the next day, for the next week? And then the shame and the regret and wondering what I said and what I did. And it was just this constant like churning. And when I removed all of that, it was like, just this sense of peace. That and the confidence, the new level of confidence that was so unexpected and I didn't even realize I had been missing. Just keeping those promises to myself, living into that, like being the person that I knew I was meant to be, instead of always fighting with, you know, sort of what alcohol turned me into. And the two just didn't reconcile. And it just, so much unexpected confidence grew out of the whole process that was really sort of surprising.
That's a good one. A good one.
That is a good one. Hadley, how can we reframe quitting as an act of self-care and not of deprivation? And I am still guilty some days of saying, I don't drink, I don't smoke, like somebody just let me eat sugar or whatever. I say it to Kathleen all the time. I'm just like, just give me my piece of cake. Okay. How many things can I quit doing?
I deserve something. Point? Yeah.
Yes. And so to me, that does say something, right? That I'm like just deep down suggesting it is an act of deprivation.
Well, I think we're all kind of moving in the right direction in that regard, in recognizing more publicly, you know, there's been more focus recently on the fact that alcohol is a group one carcinogen that directly causes seven types of cancer, at least. You know, it's a toxin, it's poison, it has this effect on our mental health, it has this effect on our gut for women in middle age, the effect on our hormones and all of this. I think these consequences are becoming more well known, and it's starting to crowd out the narrative of, oh, a glass of red wine a day is good for your heart, and it's got, you know, antioxidants and resveratrol and all, it's good for us. I think the narrative is starting to shift, and that's an important step in the right direction, and people understanding that, oh, maybe this isn't great for me. But I think honestly, it's the conversations like this that we're all having that are going to help get us there, where people are explaining that it's not an act of deprivation. I was guilty too. I thought, like, when even that morning when I made this decision, I thought, like, I am making this huge sacrifice. Mm-hmm. Like, this, I have to do it. I'm at the point where I know I have to do it, but this is going to be awful, right? But I very quickly started to realize that it felt like the opposite of that. It felt like a gift. And I don't know how we get that message across, because if you had explained to Hadley 10 years ago, it's not a sacrifice. You're going to feel so good. It's going to be amazing. I would have rolled my eyes so hard they would have popped out of my head. I wouldn't have believed it. And a lot of people are in that place. So I think we just have to keep sharing the message and hope that more people listen. Sober Instagram wasn't a thing 5 years ago that people paid attention to. There's more and more quitlet books out there where people like me are telling the story from the gray area instead of just kind of the rock bottom zone. So I think all of these things are slowly nudging us in the right direction, where people are going to start realizing that maybe alcohol's not doing all the favors we think it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, my next question was going to be about what is something you wish more women knew about quitting drinking? And maybe you just answered it about the about how amazing it does feel, and that the sacrifice, it doesn't seem like so much of a sacrifice after. But is there anything else that you wish women knew before quitting drinking?
Yeah, I wish more women knew and understood. I mean, it's all kind of connected, right? But just this idea that gets perpetuated, especially through social media now, that drinking is a form of self-care. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely the opposite of that, right? So again, this is all connected, but that's just a message that we hear constantly. Like, you deserve a glass of wine. And it ties into that whole mommy wine culture thing. Being a mom mm-hmm. is so hard. You deserve this. Take a load off. But it's hurting us. It's not helping us. Yeah. It's not self-care. It's self-harm. But nobody wants to hear that when they're in the moment and they're reaching for that glass of wine at the end of a long day with little kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. What inspired you to write The Dirty Truth on Social Drinking?
Well, early on in my journey, I read a ton of Quit Lit books. Like, I devoured them. I'm a big reader anyway. So it was like I put my mind on something and this was something tangible I could do. I could read all of these books and they were amazing. They were a huge part of my journey. They were so inspiring. But at the time, most of them were those kind of rock bottom kind of cautionary tales. I couldn't really relate. I couldn't see myself in their stories. Mm-hmm. Because I wasn't like on the verge of having my kids taken away. I wasn't getting mm-hmm. DUIs. And again, they're such important stories and they still helped me tremendously. But I kept thinking, well, there's nobody like me that's telling this story from the sort of gray area where I was yeah. considered a social drinker. Everything about my drinking seemed normal. It shouldn't have, but it did. It seemed normal. I was drinking the same way everyone around me was drinking in my social circle. And I was always a writer and I had been sharing little bits and pieces of the journey on social media. And so many people were saying, oh my gosh, me too, me too. And I thought, well, maybe I can tell the story from a different angle. So I just dove in and it was a wild ride, but so much
was
fun.
It?
Yeah.
I think that those books that you're talking about, I did the same thing. I read a ton of Quit Lit. I think for gray area drinkers, they're great to show you like what could happen. It imparts a little bit of fear.
Did you know your actual age might not be the same as your biological age? That's right. It's not just about your birth date. Your body could be older or younger than you think. That's where True Diagnostic comes in. With their True Age test, you can discover your true biological age, plus get insights into things like your risk for heart disease, Alzheimer's, and even early mortality. And the best part, it's all done from the comfort of your own home. No prescriptions, no lab visits, just a simple test sent right to your door. By tracking your biological age, you can actually see how the changes you make, whether it's to your exercise, diet, or sleep, affect your health over time. It's about taking actionable steps to improve your well-being. Oh, and if you're wondering about high-profile people taking it seriously, Brian Johnson, the guy who's working on reversing aging, and I watched his documentary on Netflix, uses True Diagnostic to track his progress. Ready to find out your biological age? Right now, our listeners can get 20% off their entire order at truediagnostic.com by using the code CIS2025 at checkout. That's True Diagnostic, TRUDIAGNOSTIC.com. Just use the code SIS2025 to save 20%. Plus, if you subscribe, you'll get an additional 20% off the 50% discount. Discover your true age today.
But you're right. It's hard to relate to when you're not waking up and, you know, craving a drink before work, or agree, like you're not driving drunk. And so, yeah, I think we need more books like yours. And so I was actually curious what you think about, we talked a little bit about social media, but what role do you think marketing plays in normalizing excessive drinking?
Oh, it's huge, right? The big alcohol machine is massive. It's where we were with tobacco. Well, I don't know, maybe even bigger. I don't know in terms of like the amount of money thrown behind it and all of that, and how that would compare back when big tobacco was kind of front and center. But you look at here in the US, like the Super Bowl ads. And mm-hmm. I'm watching with my kids, you know, I have teenage boys and we talk about this a ton, obviously, but I'm watching these beer ads, and it's like, it's just pushed on us so hard. You go through the grocery store, and our grocery stores that sell beer and wine, it varies by state in terms of what the laws are around where you can sell alcohol. But in Virginia, where I am, beer and alcohol or beer and wine are sold at the grocery store. It's like a quarter of the grocery store is these huge aisles dedicated to alcohol. It's insane. So it's hard to think, oh, maybe this isn't great for us. Maybe this isn't normal. Maybe, you know, because it's just shoved down our throat from all angles. You got the direct marketing, but then you've got the way it's portrayed in shows. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my generation grew up thinking that being a successful woman was synonymous with sipping cosmopolitans in New York City because of Sex and the City. Like, that was what I grew up on. And I drink Cosmos because of it. You know, it's,
oh my God, yeah.
It has a huge impact.
Have you noticed differences in how men and women experience social drinking?
Yeah, I pay attention to this more now than I ever did, just because my husband does still drink. He's what I call a moderation unicorn. Like, he can take it or leave it. But, you know, we talk about mommy wine culture, but there's also this like beer dad culture,
right?
Too. That's it's different. It's like they took that and they pinkified it for women, and went all in on it. But this like daddy needs a beer, and I bought my husband a t-shirt back in the day that when I still drank, that was like beer loading, and it was like the computer bar, and he would wear it to like the kids' soccer games and stuff, and it's like it makes me cringe now. So I mean, I think there's obviously subtle differences, but I think we've been paying more attention the way it's been marketed towards women, because that was more of a recent shift. But you see the whole, like, the way, if you watch shows like Yellowstone, or it's like the men drink whiskey, and there's this whole like, it's always whiskey in shows. And but yeah, so it's also pushed hard, but it's just kind of marketed differently. And I don't know, it's interesting to pay attention to.
I'm so happy you brought up that your husband still drinks, because that is the next topic we wanted to talk about. And so what was his reaction when you first told him you were not going to drink anymore? Or did you even tell him to begin with?
Yeah, he was a little bit surprised, only because no one in my life knew that I struggled with this. I kept it so private. And again, because my drinking looked normal from the outside, it wasn't like people were like, "Ooh, Hadley has a problem. She really needs to cut back." I was so ashamed of it that I kept it inside. Of course, there were little issues like, "Oh, please don't black out tonight." Or the conversations that married couples have, like, can we take it easy tonight? Like, we've got stuff tomorrow. So he was surprised. I don't think I said right away, when I, that morning when I woke up and said I was done, I kind of sat on that for a while. I didn't talk about it out loud. I did establish an alibi. I said I was doing 75 hard. I was really only doing it for the no alcohol piece. Like, I had a reason to check that box, and I had a reason to tell people that I wasn't drinking. And I felt like I sort of needed that in the beginning. So it was like a week or two before I started saying things like, I think I'm done. And I know people say we don't talk about forever. You don't have to say you're done drinking forever and just worry about the next day. But I knew that in my heart that this was it for me. But I was just afraid to say that because I had all those scary thoughts like, what if he doesn't believe me? Or what if I fail and then I look stupid? Or that kind of stuff. So I very slowly started opening up about how I'd been feeling and how my drinking made me feel and why I was done. And he was kind of shocked, like, I can't believe you didn't tell me this. You've been feeling this way? Like, I can't believe I didn't know. But he was incredibly supportive and has been ever since.
That is good. That is good that he was supportive. That's really good.
Yeah, of course. Because it seems like common sense, but
it's not.
It's not always commonplace.
Yeah. It's not always commonplace. What do you think some of the biggest challenges, what are some of the biggest challenges that couples face when one partner quits drinking?
Well, I think, you know, there were definitely still challenges, and part of it was because drinking had been our thing. Mm-hmm. Like, we live in Virginia wine country. That's what people do for everything. Is we go to wineries. It's somebody's birthday. You rent a limo. You do a winery tour. And just drinking was always, let's go have a glass of wine, or let's open a bottle tonight after the kids go to bed, or let's go get drinks. So all of a sudden it's like, wait, how does this work? And you have to sort of reestablish those habits and patterns. And that takes time, but it also takes a lot of communication, just like with most things in relationships. And I think people struggle with that, and it's setting boundaries, right? That was important for me. That was something I had to figure out. Like, if you want to, I didn't feel like I can't have any alcohol in the house. It all has to be gone, and you can't drink in front of me. If I had said those things, I feel confident that he would have supported me. But I didn't feel that way. But I did say, please just don't drink red wine. Because that was like my thing. And I was like, that'll be hard for me if you like open a bottle of red and are sipping while we're like having dinner or watching a movie. You want to have bourbon. I don't care. Yep. And then it was things like, okay, if we have date night, can you not like have three cocktails and be like buzzed and annoying? Because that's not going to resonate with me anymore. And then you're not really like connecting. So you sort of figure those boundaries out as you go. Like, I really don't want to have to buy you alcohol. Can you buy your own alcohol? Yeah. But then over time it was like, okay, well, I'm at Costco and you need a case of beer for the lake house. Like, this is silly. Like, I'm not going to make you come back for it. I'll just buy, you know. So again, those things like shift over time, but you have to talk about it, and you have to, you have to figure it out as you go, and you have to be willing to communicate. I remember one time after we were hanging out with all our neighbors outside one evening, and the next morning, the big tumbler he uses for his bourbon and coke was sitting in the sink, and I was like, oh no, you gotta take care of that. Like, I can't smell that. Like, just please don't leave that for me. So it's things like that you kind of figure out as you go. But I think it's different because depending on, again, what your relationship with alcohol was like, you might be someone that's like, I can't have any alcohol in the house.
Yeah.
I can't be around people that are drinking. I can't go to a bar. I can't. And all of that is fine. And it might change with time or it might not, but you have to talk about those boundaries.
Yeah. How have his drinking patterns changed, do you think, since you quit, or have they?
I was thinking about this recently, and I think they have. He's always been the very moderate, take it or leave it drinker. But I think he drinks less because I think a lot of times I was the instigator.
Mm-hmm. You
know? It was yeah. like Friday night. Well, let's open a bottle of wine. Let's have a drink. Let's.
Yeah.
And now that I'm not, it's just, I think it's not as appealing for him, or where we would go out to dinner and we would order a bottle of wine and we would finish it. Now he might order one cocktail and that's it. So I think it's naturally sort of shifted. But I know that's kind of unique to our scenario because he was so moderate to begin with. I hear from lots of women who that's not the case. Their husbands are heavy drinkers and they really struggle with that. So I know it can be a really tough challenge.
Mm-hmm. Kathleen, yeah. What do you, as a couples therapist?
Yeah,
what,
I'd be interested.
What do you? Yeah, I'm curious what you think about it.
I think it really depends on. Well, so to back up, I'm like, how do I want to answer this? I view like if someone has problematic drinking in the relationship, I actually view it like there's a third person in the relationship. So it's that impactful. It can be that impactful. Yeah. And I'm not talking about like brown bag, like, you know, DUI, although that can be, but I'm just talking about if someone is going to drink for comfort and they're not reaching out to their spouse, they're reaching out to a bottle. It's like there's a third person in the marriage. So it really depends on... It really depends on the level of drinking, the what's behind the drinking. So my partner, he is able to moderate, but he now drinks very little because of his own journey. But it was problematic. For example, he used to have like wine out and I just didn't like it because it wasn't that I wanted to drink. It was more, it didn't embody my values. And so I'm often talking to clients about, okay, as a couple, do you have shared values? Mm-hmm. And if one person is out on benders every other week, and then one person is like, I really want to take care of my body. I really don't want to have this relationship with alcohol anymore. Those are very different values.
Yeah.
So that's when it can become, well, that's, it can become problematic in that way. And then I also see couples where they both drink and they basically they drink to excess, both of them, and that just perpetuates it again and again and again.
Yeah. I'll say, I don't know if anyone else watched Muslim Matchmaker on Hulu.
No, I did not.
But a major issue, right, is whether they drink or they don't. And so, of course, being... the overthinker I am, I asked my boyfriend, who hasn't had a drink since January 1st, by the way, and I said, would you date someone who is a heavy drinker? And he was like, well, define heavy. And I was like, I don't know, 2 glasses of wine every night. And he's like, I don't know, is that big a deal? And I guess he's right. Is it? I guess it depends, right? What you're using it for. But what I said back to him was, to me, it's a values/lifestyle issue that if you're coming home and having 2 glasses of wine, I feel like there's some disconnect between who we are as people. Yeah.
Why do you need that? What job are you looking to it to do for you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, when I met my partner 5 years ago, he was a much heavier drinker than he is now. He definitely would come home, crack open the bottle of wine. His like wine glass was filled up to the top, and that's how he relaxed. And he does not do that anymore. He drinks non-alcoholic beer when he's socializing because he like wants to still go out with the guys and do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But now he has occasionally a glass of wine purely for enjoyment, and it's not filled up to the brim. Because he just feels so much better.
Yeah.
Physically, he's like, why would I go back to it when I just feel so much better? And that sort of leads me into the next section that we're going to talk about, which is the physical benefits. So, you know, as a lifelong runner, Hadley, how has sobriety impacted your physical performance?
So much. I noticed a difference in my running almost right away.
Wow.
Because when you're pushing through 10-mile runs on Saturday morning with a hangover and you're dehydrated, like, it's awful. So as an endurance runner, we're literally used to pushing our bodies to the extreme, and you have this sort of mentality, I can get through anything. And that would include being dehydrated on a long run because it's on the calendar, so you got to do it. But you feel miserable. And I certainly wasn't, doing my body any favors. I wasn't, you know, improving my performance. I was surviving those runs. And then my body was like fighting to recover, not just from the run, but from the hangover. And so I was really, I was really like shooting myself in the foot as I went. So I noticed a difference right away in that you feel better running when you're, one, getting quality sleep, which happens after you quit drinking, because sleep is a huge part of your fitness performance. So it was just, everything was feeding into it. So I just felt over time, you start to notice the benefits compounding. Like, I noticed little things right away, like the, oh, well, this long weekend run is a lot better when I haven't been drinking all week and I'm fighting those cumulative hangovers. But then over time, it was just starting to feel more healthy in general. Just everything starts to feel better. I also, kind of overlaying this, I had a bunch of health issues that I had sort of ignored because honestly, it was hard to tease out the symptoms when I was hungover every weekend. I had some major gut issues and thyroid problems that were flaring and were probably exacerbated by the drinking. And once I quit drinking, they all kind of rose to the surface and I was able to address them. And so that took, I mean, it was like a year of working with a special doctor to figure out the gut issues and all of that. So I was sort of in this place where I was like fluctuating. Like, I felt better, but I was also kind of sick. And so I was trying to figure that out. And I knew that I wouldn't have been able to address the health stuff if I was still drinking. I wouldn't have been able to figure out what was going on. And so that in and of itself was a big benefit because I was finally able to really feel better. But it wasn't a quick process. And everybody's always like, oh, did you lose a bunch of weight? Did you? I was like, oh, no, actually, I gained 30 pounds because I had thyroid stuff and gut stuff and all of this that I was figuring out. But it was kind of a long process. But yeah, I feel so much stronger as a runner. As someone who, as a fitness coach and a runner, talked this big game about being healthy and self-care and all of this stuff for so long while also drinking and feeling like crap regularly, it was like, oh, this is what feeling healthy really, this is what it really feels like. This is what it's supposed to feel like.
Yeah, I strongly encourage people to take even a break from drinking to see if it resolves some of their medical issues. It was the same with me. I had asthma and really severe food allergies. And when I quit drinking, all of a sudden, I don't think I've used my inhaler in maybe a couple of years. And yeah, my food allergies are really easy to deal
with. The inflammation, right?
Yeah, because my esophagus was inflamed. And if you think about it, I was like pouring poison down my esophagus. Yeah. And I kept going to get these endoscopies. And it's amazing that you'll convince yourself of that these things aren't related. And drinking is one cause of esophageal cancer and certainly of like oral cancers. And so, and then there was a period in there where I was drinking and smoking cigarettes in like my 20s, where was when it actually got really exacerbated. And so, yeah. But Hadley, so did you really lean into exercise then as a coping mechanism as you were reducing alcohol? And how do you talk to your clients too about that?
I did lean into exercise. It was an important part of my sort of self-care routine. I would say it didn't look that different from the outside because I'd always been a runner. I'd always been really into fitness. The difference was I felt a shift because instead of running and working out to sort of punish my body and sweat out the wine and to make up for the calories and all of this, it was like all of that was suddenly off the table. Now I could just run and exercise because I loved it and because I was like honoring my body. I was taking care of it. I wasn't punishing it anymore. So that shift felt really important. The one other thing I did sort of add in when I quit drinking was a lot of walking outside. So in addition to running, because I don't run every day. And so on the days that I don't run, I realized that I was hardly getting any steps in because I would lift weights for an hour or something in the morning. And then I was just sitting behind my desk all day. And so I found that walking outside was like therapy for me. I just felt like all of a sudden in sobriety, like I connected with nature more. I wanted to be outside. I wanted to go hiking. I needed sunshine. Like I craved it. So that's something that stuck, and I walk a ton now. And in this weather, it like kills me. I'll still walk on the treadmill on days that I don't run, but I'm like, oh, I need to be outside, even if it's cold. It's just something about the fresh air is really healing.
Kathleen, walking pad.
Oh, I know.
I just got a walking pad.
Oh, did you?
And I love it because it was the same way that I noticed that I wasn't closing the activity rings necessarily on my watch on days when I didn't do cardio. And so the walking pad it's so fun because you can move it around unlike a treadmill. So
yeah,
you can just like roll it to anywhere in your house.
And,
you
could even
So like on a nice day, you could roll it onto your deck if you don't feel like going for a walk. And it's just like there. So I am going to recommend a walking pad.
I know. Sonia's been telling me about this, but I feel like because I see clients all day long, what am I going to do with this? I'll be like, tell me about how you feel.
Don't mind me. I'll just be walking. Well, then you have to add in the weighted vest because.
Oh my gosh.
Because now there's all of these studies that show that for women approaching midlife, the weighted vest actually helps you maintain muscle mass and bone density. All of these big menopause doctors are talking about it. So I got one for Christmas and it's awesome.
Okay. I have ankle weights. I have these cute pink ankle weights, but weighted vest is the new thing. I'm always like 3 steps behind.
It's always something, right? I mean, at the very least, it increases your like caloric burn. You're working harder.
Yeah. I was at Kathleen's house on Friday and I was like so proud of myself that I'm reducing my dairy. And I was like, guess what? I'm drinking oat milk. And she's like, literally the worst one you could drink. She's like the highest like glycemic. And I was like, I was so happy that I had cut out like this piece of dairy from my life. And she was just like shaking her head. And then I went out to lunch with my friend and I was like, guess what? I've been drinking oat milk. And she was just like,
it's hard to keep up with all the
rules.
It's
hard to keep up. Yeah, you should have seen the look on her face with the oat milk.
That's funny. That makes me laugh.
How do you think that someone could integrate fitness more into their journey towards sobriety?
I think that movement helps 100%. I mean, that's just a fact. Moving your body helps with lots of things, but a lot of the issues that we turn to alcohol for, right? Like stress and anxiety and all of these things, exercise is going to help with, right? It boosts your mood. It improves your mental health. So honestly, what I always say is like, not everybody is interested in quitting drinking and running their first marathon or like embracing CrossFit, or you don't have to do something extreme. Mm-hmm. Just like we were saying, just start going for a walk. Start with a 10-minute stroll, but moving your body in some way is going to help. It's going to help when you are, it can only ever help, right? Mm-hmm. So just add something, but using that as part of your self-care toolkit when you quit drinking is incredibly important, because the benefits in terms of helping you sleep, helping with your mood and boosting those endorphins and all of that. I mean, the benefits are too long to even list. Mm-hmm. But again, people are like, well, I'm not going to join a gym, or I'm not going to, just go for a 10-minute walk. Start somewhere. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do something dramatic.
Yeah, it's so true. I found such a difference. I walk now. I have like a half hour walk in the morning with my dog when it's not like when there's not 6 feet of snow, but generally I'm doing that. And then I try to walk at least 10 minutes after every meal. And I've really noticed such a difference in my mental health. It's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what is next for you, Hadley? Is there anything that you're working on, and how can our listeners get in touch with you?
So I am working on my next book, and it's actually still in the alcohol space, but it's very different. It's a novel. So it's fiction, but it's about a group of women who are all connected, and they all have very different relationships with alcohol. So it looks at the different places we can fall on that alcohol use disorder spectrum. So that is what is coming next. If you want to get in touch with me, Instagram is where I spend most of my time online. I love my little sobriety community out there. My DMs are always open. I'm always happy to chat. I spend a lot of time out there. So it's just at Hadley_Sorensen. My website is HadleySorensen.com, and you can find my book on Amazon, The Dirty Truth on Social Drinking.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. This was a great conversation. It was fun.
And thank you all for listening to Sisters in Sobriety, and we will see you next week.